Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Naughan. You're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we're going to go to Vienna in Austria and speak with Dr. Christian Fiala, F-I-A-L-A. He is a gynecologist and obstetrician based in Vienna, and earlier he had extensive medical experience working in Africa and Thailand. In 2007, he established the Museum for Contraception and Abortion, the only museum of its kind. For 20 years, he has critically followed the scientific and peer review and political debates on the epidemiology of AIDS. He was a member of the Presidential AIDS Advisory Panel in South Africa and currently sits on the board of Rethinking AIDS. He's published many papers on the problems of AIDS in Africa and the definition of AIDS, and is the author of the book, Do We Love Dangerously? A Doctor in Search of the Facts and Background to AIDS. Nice to have you with us again.
Thank you for the invitation.
I'm going to ask you a question that I'm sure is going to take quite a little time to answer, but please take that time. Back in late 2008 or early 2009, a Dr. Andrew Mateos and Charles Geschechter wrote an article suggesting that the way AIDS is being handled in Africa, including giving high doses of AZT or similar drugs, is an iatrogenic depopulation strategy, meaning that the actual drug is leading to and causing death. I'd like for you to address that. And also, can you share anything about the work of the German physician, Dr. Klaus Köhnlein, who's been treating AIDS patients for over 10 years without AZT or its related cousins. Could we begin there, please?
Well, yes, thank you. It's really my pleasure to contribute in an evidence-based way and looking really at the facts and analyzing the facts regardless where they may lead us. And one of the underlying problems is what do we mean when we talk about AIDS? Most people will probably not be aware that the definition of AIDS most people will probably not be aware that the definition of AIDS is artificial and has been changed repeatedly, and it is very different from one continent to another. Especially the definition being used in Africa has nothing to do with the definition being used in Europe, and there's quite a significant difference between the definition of AIDS being used in the States and that one being used in Europe. So when we talk about AIDS and the clinical treatment, medical treatment of AIDS, we have to keep in mind that we are talking about very, very different things in different locations. In summary, what all these definitions have in common is that they are remake of old, already existing diseases. So diseases that have been out there since ever, like cervical cancer, like pneumonia, have been renamed, relabeled as AIDS under certain conditions. So what we actually have is we don't have new patients. That is, we don't have patients with a new disease. We just have patients with diseases which we know very well, which have been out there since ever. Only we give them a new name. And together with this new name comes a new treatment approach. And maybe this is what makes the difference between Dr. Köhnlein and many other AIDS specialists, that he looks at the patients and their symptoms and the underlying diagnosis, and he treats patients according to their clinical diagnosis, not according to a relabeled new definition which has little meaning and has produced so far no beneficial clinical treatment.
A larger question, if you would. Thank you for that answer. When I look at Africa, and I've studied AIDS in Africa from the time it was first diagnosed as being an epidemic there, we're told that it's infectious and it's sexually transmitted both. And yet, in all the countries, and I went through every country in Africa, I went through all their medical statistics, and what I find is that very wealthy individuals, industrialists, heads of banks, diamond companies, they don't have AIDS-defining illnesses. When I look at medical doctors and look at the professional class, lawyers, professors, CPAs, architects, accountants, they don't have the AIDS conditions. When I look at the upper middle class bureaucracies, they don't have it. When I look at the when I look at the business mercantile class, business owners, they don't have it. And most of your bureaucrats don't. But then you have this large divide. And over the other side of the divide, you have poverty. You have people who don't have good nutrition, who don't have clean water, who are caught in civil war and who are in migration, who live in refugee camps. And there you have large numbers of people diagnosed with AIDS. Now, if it's sexually transmitted and if it's infectious, then everyone in Africa, from Egypt and the other countries in northern Africa, should be just as susceptible to those in middle Africa or southern Africa or Ecuador, Africa, and they're not. So how is it that what we're calling AIDS seems to be very definitely related to a person's socioeconomic and health conditions?
Well, if you look at the definition of AIDS, especially the definition for Africa, and it is really important to keep in mind that WHO defined and published a specific AIDS definition only for Africa in 1986, the so-called Bangui definition. And if you look at this definition, it becomes so obvious that what we call AIDS in reality is a relabeling of poverty-based diseases, poverty-related diseases. And so it is no surprise that even in Africa, those people who are said to be suffering from AIDS are mostly those suffering from poverty. And it is kind of a cheap excuse for the West to say, oh no, these people, they are not suffering from economic poverty, which might be changed. They are suffering from their own sexual drive, which is without any medical basis. And it is really scandalous that we as the West, we don't support people in Africa, poor people in Africa, to get out of their poverty, like helping them to get clean drinking water. Instead, we make them believe that it's their own fault. They are suffering from these diseases, and we are giving them toxic, highly toxic drugs, which will just make things worse or even kill them, and which is really cynical. And I think it's unprecedented that we try to overcome poverty with toxic, highly toxic drugs. This will never work, and it will never help people on the ground to get out of their poverty and the problems associated with poverty. We need to be reminded that poverty is not a romantic issue. It's really a struggle for survival, and really survival is a question of living and death. So it is actually quite cynical, our approach of AIDS, especially in Africa. And on a more general level, I think it is really striking to see that what the last 20 years we have seen a lot of predictions, a lot of announcements on HIV/AIDS, on vaccines, on epidemics, on death, on mortality. And if you look at all these, if you remember all these predictions, they have one thing in common, that is they prove to be completely wrong. All these predictions were completely wrong. And I think it is really high time to reevaluate and rethink what we call HIV and AIDS in view of this impressive failure to fulfill these predictions. Because if these predictions did not come true, then obviously the underlying assumptions were wrong. And I think we really need to revise these underlying assumptions.
Good. Then let's do a follow-up to that line of thought. With AIDS, you're given a blood test to test for antibodies. And if you come up positive on this, there's a confirmation backup test, and then you're immediately put on medications as their first line of defense. And one of the most popular medications and most heavily used was AZT. Now, is it not true that there are over 75 separate conditions, pregnancy being one, arthritis, herpes, tuberculosis, malaria, among these that will also give you a false positive reading, and also the symptoms that they define a person as having AIDS without even doing a blood chemistry are virtually the same as a person who's malnourished, suffering from malaria or tuberculosis? They're virtually indistinguishable in the symptoms, and wasting away, a non-productive cough for a month or more, having a yeast overgrowth. And so looking at a person who is that sick because they cannot afford or do not have access to anti-malarial treatment or tuberculosis treatment or nutrition, they could be given, with a devastated immune system, one of the single most toxic drugs ever created, so toxic it was not allowed to be used on patients in cancer chemotherapy because of its toxicity, yet that's the drug that's used. And instead of stopping and saying, hold on a second, why don't we simply try giving this person good health, the medicines that would normally be used to treat tuberculosis or malaria or whatever it is, instead of the approach they're taking? Your thoughts on that, please.
Well, you're completely right. One of the big problems and actually scandals in HIV/AIDS is the non-respect of evidence and non-acceptance of evidence. It's really driven by hysteria and thoughts and ideology. And the HIV tests are a very good example because the HIV tests actually, they don't measure the virus, the actual HIV. They measure antibodies, which are supposed to be directed against this HIV virus. But as you mentioned, there are so many clinical conditions like vaccination, like pregnancy, like malaria, like other diseases, which lead to a positive result in this HIV test and make it very difficult to interpret. And even if you look at the product information, the manufacturer of the test, they go even further. They are going further. They don't talk about false positives. In the product information, you can read, for example, in one of the in the product information of one of the biggest manufacturers of HIV test, you can read the citation: at present, there is no recognized standard for establishing the presence or absence of HIV antibodies in human blood. End quote. Now, this may sound harmless to you, but imagine you would be a woman missing her period. You would go to a gynecologist and he said, well, I can make a very reliable pregnancy test, and you would read the manufacturer's brochure to that pregnancy test, and the manufacturer would write in this pregnancy test, at present there is no recognized standard to verify the presence or absence of a pregnancy in human body, end quote. Would you still believe your doctor who claims that this pregnancy test nevertheless is very reliable? And would you believe the result of such a test? You would probably run away and be scandalized, and you may even go to court, bring this doctor to court for malpractice, because how could he possibly do a test on you when apparently there has never been a recognized standard on how to interpret the result of this test? So this comparison with a pregnancy test just indicates and makes it understandable for everyone to see how basically unreliable these tests are. Even the manufacturer admit that they have no idea how to verify the accuracy of their tests. So if the manufacturer has no idea how to verify these tests, I, as clinician, I feel I should not do such a test on my patient. And if I would be a patient and a doctor would do such a test on me with such a claim in the notice, in the product information, then I would sue my doctor for malpractice, regardless whether this is a test on HIV or on pregnancy. So as long as we have not solved this underlying basic question, what do we measure with HIV tests? As long as this is still an open question, it's absolutely useless to continue any other discussion, or let alone base any clinical treatment on such a highly unreliable test.
Appreciate the answer. Just one more important question for your experience in Africa. We are told that it's mainly sexually transmitted. We've been given all kinds of strange scenarios that truck drivers will pick up a prostitute, get infected, and then infect another prostitute who will then infect whoever they're having sex with, and that's how this happened. And yet, all the studies have shown that porn workers in the United States having millions of sexual episodes over the last 25 years without protection, you didn't have any of the AIDS-defining illnesses. Also, in Africa, people who were measured, who were prostitutes, who acknowledged being prostitutes, there was no epidemic of AIDS or AIDS-defining illnesses or HIV infection in these women. Also, in a clinic there, it would take orphans, AIDS orphans, and instead of giving the AIDS orphans, all of whom were going to die, and all were suffering from malnutrition, instead of giving them AZT and drugs, the doctor running the clinic instead gave them medicines they actually needed for their real medical conditions and good nutrition and clean water, and they all ended up being healthy. None ended up having AIDS. And yet you would have thought that that would have drawn some interest from around the world, from the media, from the medical community. So none of these anomalies, taking HIV, AIDS diagnosed kids, all of them, reversing their AIDS by simply giving them good, wholesome food and water, clean water, and proper medical care, and they're all natural, normal, and healthy. And yet no one looks at these as being significant. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I think AIDS, this HIV-AIDS discussion really points to a basic problem in science, that science to some extent has become a belief system and is not based on facts, verifiable facts, and an exchange of the best arguments. Instead, some beliefs are spread, and people are forced, and scientists and clinicians and doctors and media are forced by economic means to spread these beliefs and to reiterate them, even if they are completely wrong and verifiably wrong. And the examples you just gave are just proving this point. HIV tests are known to be fundamentally unreliable. It's not that they are just slightly unreliable.
All right,
in
let's
some
take that
situations.
Further. What have you found is the number one cause of death in people who are defined as having AIDS?
Well, all this depends on where you, on which
Hello,
continent
are you,
you are, and in which we, even there is a huge difference between the States and Europe, and there's an even bigger difference to Africa. In Africa, the main problem is poverty-related diseases, that is malnutrition, respiratory tract infections, gastric infections. These are the main main problem, health problems of people in Africa. And they have not changed over the time, and there is no indication, not a single indication, that the health problems in Africa are related to a virus, that they are transmitted, and there is absolutely no indication that the health problems of people in Africa are sexually transmitted. On the very contrary, even in addition to the examples you gave on the States and in Europe, where we don't find female prostitutes, female sex workers being at risk for HIV, where we don't find an epidemic in the general heterosexual population. Even in Africa, if you look at the epidemiological data, there is absolutely no indication for a sexually transmitted infection. In fact, there is evidence to the contrary. There's evidence that HIV positive tests are not related to sexually transmitted diseases. Like in most countries, when they do HIV tests, they also do a syphilis test. So syphilis is a well-established STD, sexually transmitted disease. Strangely enough, there is no correlation between those people who have a syphilis infection and those who are positive in an HIV test. So if syphilis is well-recognized STD and there is no correlation, so you take regions in Africa with a high rate of syphilis, would you find a low rate of HIV tests? And on the other hand, you take a region with a low rate of syphilis, you find a high rate of HIV prevalence. And even over time, we found a reduced frequency, a reduced prevalence of syphilis, and a claimed increase of HIV, for example, in Africa. But I also did these epidemiological studies in Thailand. So actually, you find a geographical inverse correlation between syphilis and HIV, and a chronological inverse relation between HIV and syphilis. So this clearly is a proof that if both are infections, they cannot be shared or transmitted by the same mode of transmission. They have absolutely nothing to do with each other.
In the United States, during the 1980s and 90s, we were told that the next giant wave of HIV-positive people would be in teenagers because of unprotected and substantial amounts of sexual activity. Indeed, we did find an increase in unplanned pregnancies, herpes, 1, 2, and 6, gonorrhea, syphilis, chlamydia. We did not find HIV infection in the same group of people. So if HIV is sexually transmitted, and is supposed to be easily transmitted, then we should have seen it proportional to the increases in sexually transmitted diseases and unwanted pregnancies. We did not. So, but when you check intravenous drug users in the United States, people whose immune systems are completely shattered, people whose blood is a toxic sewer with all forms of viruses, including hepatitis, which will also test you positive, there we are supposedly getting into the mother load of HIV infection. Yet if I take 1,000 IV drug users who are 19 years old, I'm going to have a high percentage test positive for HIV, and a certain amount will have AIDS-related symptoms. If I take another 1,000 teenagers, same age, and who are non-drug users, I'm going to find none, zero. So none of these are about sex. It's about the immune system. And exactly. So then are they going to say, well, HIV only infects intravenous drug users? The logic behind how they position this is simply so astoundingly foolish. And yet an entire $800 billion paradigm is based upon it. So here is my question. Knowing that we have people who've staked their entire careers, some people are now in the 25th year, a quarter of a century of living by feeding off the AIDS hysteria. You have at least 2 million people who've worked in the AIDS field or are related to it. You have gay foundations, you have labs at major universities, you have whole federal agencies, you have the UN, you have pharmaceutical companies. It's not even possible, in my opinion, for any of these people, including the media, to ever acknowledge they got anything wrong. It's not possible for Science Magazine, even though there was a petition, to look at Robert Gallo's four articles and challenge them. So if the entire foundation upon what AIDS is and is not is flawed, then how is it possible for anyone at any level, from the gay activist to the media like the New York Times to Bono and Sharon Stone and the others who've supported AIDS fundraising, the Elton John, to the pharmaceutical companies, to the foundations, of which there have been more than 75,000, to the clinicians, to the physicians, to the nurses, to the hospitals, all of them would be open for massive litigation. Class action lawsuits like we've never seen in world history. It would virtually bankrupt the entire medical industrial complex. So how is it possible for anyone in the paradigm who's benefited off the myth to acknowledge complicity in this fraud?
Well, that's a very good question, and it's really a difficult question, because the real scandal in HIV is that the evidence and the facts, the verifiable facts, are not acknowledged and not taken into consideration. Instead, we continue a belief system, and the longer this HIV theory takes, the more it resembles the former system of bloodletting. It becomes really very similar, and it is a tragic that one of your former president was killed by bloodletting. And this was a similar belief system which was also upheld by the medical society and the scientific society at that time. And so there are really more and more parallels developing between these belief systems. And I think HIV/AIDS is actually not a medical scientific question. It's a belief question. And we need to handle it as a belief system, like we had other belief system, like communism, for example, has also been a belief system which collapsed. And I think we have to tackle and confront HIV/AIDS as a belief system, otherwise we need to wait until all those who have benefited from the system have retired or died away, until the new generation will hopefully reverse this belief system. But it's clear that all the scientific questions have been answered. It's a fraud. We have been disappointed over more than two decades. None of the predictions have proven right. In fact, all the predictions proved wrong. And the only solution to this is to reevaluate all the data and to go back to basics. That's what we truly should do in science. And not what we are currently doing with HIV, actually, is mixing a belief system and taking it as a pseudoscience. And that will not be able to continue forever, because it is wrong. It becomes more and more apparent that it's wrong, and people will simply not believe it anymore.
Christian, I'd like to tell you a little story, and then I'd like your response on it, please. In the mid-1990s, I had a gentleman come in to our medical center in New York, the Tri-State Healing Center. And every evening, 7 days a week, starting at 5 o'clock and going till midnight, 7 hours, the only people who were being treated by the medical staff were HIV-positive, AIDS-defined or ARC-defined patients. And word had gone throughout the gay community, it was principally gay, but also intravenous drug users and some hemophiliacs, that we used holistic therapy, and there have been very good results, because many of the people within the gay community had been there. They had been helped and gone back and spread the word. Also, one of the leading medical doctors in the gay community was a man named Stephen Chiesa. And he had been working before the AIDS crisis helping men with the unique conditions of anal intercourse, unprotected anal intercourse, and the immunosuppressive impact of sperm in the gastrointestinal tract, plus the problems of what happens when you lacerate or puncture the gastrointestinal tract, and then fecal material ends up in the body, and you end up with septicemia and many other very toxic and frequently fatal conditions. And he gave me a call, and I was working with Stephen for a long time. I would take his patients that he was using an aqueous-based vitamin A, which was rare, and he was treating people with syphilis, but I was doing the other work on helping them reestablish their immune competence by building up their immune system. A gentleman came in one day, and he said, I'm from California. I heard about you all, and I want to tell you a story. And I said, what is it? He said, over the last 12 years, I have been in no less than 20 support groups. Over 2,000 persons with AIDS were in those support groups. Some were small, some were larger. Every single one died. Not one was alive. I was the only one in these AIDS support groups that were using diet and wheatgrass juice and other things he was talking about. And he said, and I would be hounded. In fact, one group didn't want me there because when it came time to talk, I would talk about how better I felt and how my blood chemistry, even though my T cells were low, which was due to some drug use I had engaged in. But otherwise, I was feeling great. And one time in Los Angeles at a AIDS support group, a fella from one of the ACT UP groups came and really berated me. And he berated me by saying, when you come here and you talk this nonsense and you're against the drugs, you could easily get people away from proven therapies, the drugs. So I said to the guy, can you show me anyone who's using AZT, DDI, DDC, protease inhibitors who are alive and well, equal to myself? And he said, of course, there are many. He says, well, I haven't seen any. Can you show them to me? Point them out in this room. And there was a big argument. He was told to leave and not come back. And he said that he did go back, but he stopped going when the people died. So here he was in New York. Now, this was unusual because I'd never spoken with him or anyone like this, that every single person using the orthodox approach, listening to the people from ACT UP, listening to those who were the hardwired, true believing, cult-like mindset of Big Pharma's got the ticket, Big Pharma's got the answer, and all their patients dead. He was alive. So we put him on a holistic protocol, ones that he had not used. He had not known about intravenous vitamins, glutathione pushes, homeopathic zeolites, ozone intravenous or autohemotherapy. He was unfamiliar with all this. In a period of under 13 months, he seroconverted to HIV negative, but he was in a room with others, and the other people in that room all were making improvements. 12 of those individuals ended up reversing all their AIDS-defining illnesses, pneumocystis, cranial pneumonia, Kaposi sarcoma, thrush, etc. And 16 months later, we decided to have a press conference. We invited, on three occasions, 7,000 members, the medical community, and all the major press. We took out a day at the General Media Center on Broadway in the mid-60s, and 100 individuals who had made improvement, and there were 12 there who I had personally worked with through the Tri-State Healing Center who were on my protocols. All those 100 people had their medical records, their medical doctors with them. We had a panel of outstanding physicians and academics, and so it started. Not a single member of the media showed up. Not one. Not a single member of the Orthodox AIDS community showed up.
I'm not surprised.
No one showed up, and yet it was widely publicized. Now, there was a chance if the American scientific community and if the American medical community and if the American media truly wanted to know about alternative approaches, they would have seen that we had the patients giving their own testimony. We had their medical records of all their blood workups and that show that they had the full-blown AIDS today by different techniques. They came from all over the United States. It took a year to organize. But these people are all either in full remission or fully recovered or HIV negative, totally cured. When you don't have a single person show up. Now, photographs of that and a description are up on my website. So this isn't myth. You can see there's the AIDS banner. AIDS is not a death sentence. You can see the doctors. You can see the people. You can see them getting up and telling their stories. It went on for 6 hours because each person got up and told their story. And yet not a medical writer, a journalist, a governmental agency, not even when I'd personally called the head of the AIDS group in New York City for the city of New York, no one showed up. Now, that was the final wake-up call that the truth about AIDS will never be known. And my own radio station, to this day, advocates only the orthodox approach. And for myself or anyone else who dared question the AIDS has some problems in its diagnostic tests and its treatment, in the foundation of the entire AIDS edifice, look at the proof. Look at the number one cause of death in people with AIDS is liver failure, which is not one of the 30 defining conditions. It's definitely due to iatrogenesis or the drugs. They won't look at any of this. So that told the story for me. I'd like for you to address any of this as it might relate to your own experiences.
Well, it absolutely confirms my personal experience, and it points to the fact that we are actually not in a scientific debate. We are in an ideological fight. We are in a fight about truth, belief system, and we are still trying to prove that this is wrong. This is a little bit like going to the Vatican and discussing with the Pope about Virgin Mary and saying, well, being an obstetrician myself, I can confirm this story is probably not true because simply it's not possible. And then the Pope will probably try to be polite at the beginning and try to convince me to believe in this one, at least one Virgin Mary. And if I insist and if the more and more proof I will bring, the more he will resort on a power play. And we have seen these kind of ideological fights in many, many instances. And just to give you one small example, in Vienna, there has been about 150 years ago a gynecologist called Semmelweis. And Semmelweis was an obstetrician, and he observed that maternal mortality in the delivery wards, which was run by gynecologists, by doctors, the maternal mortality was really very high. Up to 30-40% of women who gave birth died due to an infection. And clearly this motivated him to find the reason and a possible solution. Now, guess what? The solution he found, which was very easy in fact, the solution was he discovered it. Doctors didn't wash their hands before they did a vaginal examination in women being in the delivery ward. So he convinced the doctors to go to wash their hands before they would do after vaginal examination. And because he was well respected, these doctors, they followed him, his advice, although they didn't really believe in him, in his theory. So as a result of this experiment, doctors washing their hands, maternal mortality, guess what? It dropped significantly to a mere 2-5%. So Semmelweis had proven that women died from infections being transmitted by the hands of doctors. Now you would suppose that they would praise him and give him all kinds of honors and of course oblige every doctor to wash his hands before doing a vaginal examination. Sorry to disappoint you, completely wrong. They not only kicked him out of the university hospital, the city of Vienna officially banned him from entering the city because, for the simple reason, he could not be right, because it was, and that was a quote of that time, the hands of doctors could not possibly transmit death, end quote. So this reminds me very much of the situation, the debate we are in currently on HIV/AIDS. This is not a scientific debate, not at all. It's a power play. It's an ideological debate. It's a small minority which tries to defend their budgets and their influence and their power. And to do so, they need a belief system like Vatican or like the communists or like the bloodletting or numerous other belief systems which we have seen. One recent belief system, by the way, which has collapsed very fast, was a belief system in swine flu. You remember? I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, everyone was called to get a vaccination from swine flu, and it was only after 1 year that we learned that everything was faked, and actually there was no reason to get vaccinated from swine flu because that was not a specifically dangerous infection. So I think the solution to this HIV is to see it as what it is, and namely ideological power play. And we have to confront this power play not with arguments, as it is, because it's useless. It's useless to argue with the Pope about Virgin Mary. It was useless to argue with the Brezhnev about the communist system. And it was useless of people at that time to argue with them about bloodletting. It is a power play, and we have to confront that power play with the weapons used in power play.
Just a few more questions, if you would, please. At the height of this debate, there were only a handful of us in 1983, 84. Today, there are thousands of scientists, journalists, physicians who are looking at the story and finding, to their amazement, just basic science has been abrogated, has been completely eliminated, and it offends them. And that's why some Nobel Prize winners in science, in the field of AIDS, have denounced the science of AIDS or its treatment. They're physicians who know that the treatment is worse than any condition. And yet, there's still 800,000 physicians out there and millions of scientists and bureaucrats, technocrats who go along with it. I don't want to be confused by any of the science. What do you say that it could help open more minds and have those several thousand that have come over to a more enlightened side do so?
That's actually the crucial question. How can we overcome this belief system? And sometimes I really feel like Solzhenitsyn and Sakharov back in the times when they were locked up in Siberia by the former communist governors in Moscow. They fought a belief system named communism. And we are actually in the fight with a belief system called HIV/AIDS hysteria. And we have to confront this system as a belief system. And I think the best weapon against the belief system, and this is true for Virgin Mary or whatever you take, is to inform people about the facts and get to the people, discuss with them, and show them the basic facts, and so that they don't have to believe anymore or follow any belief, but that they can follow the facts and the conviction and really question what is happening and looking with their own eyes instead of following some claimed Führers, which we have, who self-proclaimed experts who try to explain us the world. But this is really something we need to work on, and probably there is not a recipe yet how to overcome this ideological barrier and to overcome this deeply cynical and unscientific HIV/AIDS hysteria, which is not only doing really tremendous damage to those people who are claimed to be affected, but it also does a huge disservice to the scientific system, because actually it is it damages the scientific system, and we need the scientific system actually as a basis for our actions, because the scientific system should provide verifiable facts and best arguments how to solve problems, those problems we have on this earth. And if this scientific system is kind of hijacked by a belief system and misused, abused for this ideological goal, then the damage, the risk for damage is much further than just for HIV/AIDS. The damage is that people will not trust anymore the scientific system, and then the only alternative we have will be some new belief system, and the belief systems will never provide any solution, because they are only interested to get to finance themselves and continue in their belief system. But I would really, if you allow me to kindly ask you to start such a debate, how can we overcome this belief system?
Well, the debate has been started, but each time that we try to debate, the people who hold the orthodox, full-fledged establishment view lose the debate, and hence they're afraid. They won't debate Peter Duisberg or Stefan Lanka from Germany, the virologist, or Dr. David Rasnick, or the people who really could show the truth of real science. They won't debate the physicians who treated the patients with holistic techniques for their original underlying conditions, more often than not, hepatitis. So that debate's not going to happen. There's too much at risk. They're just going to... They can slander people as they do, and especially ACT UP. They'll slander. Mm-hmm. I've been on the receiving end of that. And my audience knows the truth, so they could care less about what these little twerps have to say. But I've invited them on the show repeatedly. You know, don't be a coward. If you've got an issue, come forward and debate it and let the audience decide. Mm-hmm. They won't do that because they know that they would just be handed their ass on a tray. It's of that course. Simple. You know, we don't lose because we have truth on our side. They won't even go into that fight. You know, so they're cowards. They try to run up behind you and sucker punch you. Mm-hmm. But stand toe-to-toe in a debate, national debate. Let's see who comes out with the facts on their side. I can bring a lot of people who are fully recovered from AIDS. They can't. Mm-hmm. We can bring scientists, physicians, nurses who can show you the truth of how people have been falsely diagnosed. We can bring you people who were completely healthy but had hepatitis and given a diagnosis of AIDS and then put on antiretrovirals, including DNA terminators, and it nearly killed them. And the only reason they survive is they stopped the drugs. They can't bring you fully recovered persons. They've never had one. They'll promise you a vaccine. They've had 69 times that they have had vaccines supposedly going to do it, and not one has worked. So that's how it works. One last thought, and this is my last issue with you. I saw how down and dirty these people played. So what I did was this. I was invited to be the keynote speaker at a gay lecture in New York, where all the men and women there were gay men and women. And that's fine. I support gay rights, so I went. And I was giving them a talk about staying healthy, especially at a time when just being gay was considered to be enough grounds to consider you suspect for being a person with AIDS. And so I asked, how many people in here are vegetarians? All these hands went up. How many are vegans? Hands went up. How many of you take vitamins and juicing and meditation and supplements and exercise? And all these hands went up. Then I said, okay, now we're not talking about a few people, not a few hundred people. The room was packed. I'm going to guess 600, 700 people. I then said, how many of you have been tested for the HIV virus? All these hands went up. How many of you tested positive? None of the hands were up. So then I said, well, how many of you have a lot of sex? All the hands went back up. So I said, well, now this is kind of an anomaly since it's supposed to be sexually transmitted. And if you had all this sex... And if you're gay, then you should be. And a man stood up at that point, and he said, Gary, he said, I've been listening to you since 1975. And he said, I got to say that maybe you're not aware of it, but there's two gay communities. I said, well, I'm not aware of it. Please educate me. He said, there's the fast-track gays, who live a very, very open and cutting-edge existence. They take a lot of drugs. They have a lot of sexual partners. They're up all night, and they work all day. And then on the weekends, they'll go out to Fire Island or to a club downtown. And then there are the regular gays, who outside of their sexual preference are just regular human beings that you wouldn't know from their lifestyle that they're any different than anyone else. And the people in this room are very conscious about health. So he suggested that I go with him for a period of time down to the Fast Track gay bars on Christopher Street. So I did. In fact, I went for almost 2 years. I interviewed over 2,000 people, almost all gay, within the Fast Track community. I saw things like there were trucks there, and at nighttime, across the street on Christopher Street, on the docks, on the river, there'd be these empty trucks, and you'd go over and you'd look inside, and you'd see all these cigarettes lit, but you couldn't see anyone, and people go in there to have sex. But when you stepped on the floor, your feet, your shoes would feel all this crunching. These were amyl nitrate capsules. There were hundreds. And people would regularly use amyl nitrate or poppers under their nose so they could extend their sexual high, especially after they'd already had one orgasm, so they could have 10 or 15 or even 20 sexual experiences a night. I saw on one of the bars a man who had a clear jar, and he was a physician, and they were 500 milligram penicillin. And people took them like candy because the word was, if you take a handful of these, you won't get any diseases. Not true, as you know. Taking an antibiotic will not prevent a sexually transmitted disease. And then I saw the alcohol, smoking, cocaine. I saw their lifestyle, and I got to know two of the guys who were roommates. And when I first met them, they'd only been going there for about a month. And every night, they would go there. And they were having lots of sex, drinking, partying, and they would finish about 4 or 5 in the morning. They would go home, get an hour or two of sleep, and then go right in to teach. At the end of 2 years, both of them had AIDS-defining illnesses. They both died. They took their drugs. They took the antibiotics. They had only bad bacteria. The good bacteria were wiped out. And then their immune system was simply collapsed. And yet, I saw this over and over again, and when I talked to him, why are you doing this? One of them said it best. He said, because it feels so damn good, and the fact that you can go out and live your sexual fantasies every night is just phenomenal, and this is part of what Stonewall, right up the street, the nightclub, sexual liberation, it's our body, our right. And then at that time, I was counseling some fast-track heterosexuals known as swingers, you know, people with wife swapping, and they were having amyl nitrate. They were having unprotected sex, and they were having AIDS-like symptoms. But because they weren't gay, they weren't given the fast-track drugs like AZT. They were given antibiotics. So they recovered from their sexually transmitted diseases. But had they been gay, they'd been dead. So there was my dilemma. So now because of that lecture, and because I was told about the difference, but because it was politically incorrect to say there's two groups of gays, the fast track, which is about 2%, and the rest were completely normal, regular people, but they didn't have the AIDS in any statistically significant amount. But that was also true of heterosexuals. You had the fast track intravenous drug users representing under 2 to 3% of the population. They're the ones with AIDS. You had the fast track swingers. They're the ones with AIDS defining illnesses. And yet the vast majority of Americans didn't participate, either gay or straight, in the sexual revolution. But that was what I found. Your final thoughts on this?
Well, that is what I have also observed. And there is a very nice film, you probably know that, gaysinthe70s.com.
No, I haven't seen it. No.
Website gaysinthe70s.com is a film on exactly what you have been telling about. And it comes to the point, if you break it down, I mean, it's the basic fact that if you want to live a healthy life, you have to live a healthy life. I mean, you can't kind of live an unhealthy life and still hope that your body will deal with it. You live an unhealthy life, you will have to bear the consequences of an unhealthy life. And I'm not saying that in any kind of any moral background. It's everyone's own decision, whatever kind of life he wants to live or she wants to live. I have absolutely no moral objection, and I completely understand if someone wants to live multiple sexual exposures in one evening. Fine, I have no moral comment to make on that. But then, if this person is living an unhealthy lifestyle, he can't or she can't blame the consequences of this unhealthy lifestyle on others. And we have that not only in gays, we have that in cigarette smoking, we have that in obesity, we have that in alcoholics, we have that in other drug users, not only poppers. All these people, they live an unhealthy lifestyle. Fine with me, no moral judgment to make on that. But if there is a health consequence, and I'm saying that purely as a doctor observing these people, if there is a health consequence caused by this unhealthy lifestyle, well, you can't blame someone else for the life you led.
But do you see how easy it was to blame a virus? And yet the people who were sick had hepatitis B as many as three times in a single year, syphilis four to five times near the people I interviewed, and no one seems to want to know the truth of all that. Thank you very much. We're out of time. Appreciate you coming on and sharing your insights with us today.
Thank you for having me as a guest, and good luck with your show.
Thank you.
And have a look at the film Gay in the 70s.
I will.
Very, very good. It's just documenting what you have been telling.
Dr. Christian Fiala, F-I-A-L-A, my guest. He is a board-certified gynecologist and obstetrician in Vienna, Austria. Extensive medical experience working in Africa and Thailand. And he has published in peer-reviewed literature. He was on the Presidential AIDS Advisory Panel in South Africa and currently sits on the board of Rethinking AIDS. He's published many papers about the problem of AIDS in Africa, and the book is also very important as well. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all very much for listening.